Hello, everybody, and stop the press, because I have a very important announcement. Early access passes are now available for the May 2026 Grey History Tour in Paris. I'm planning a small group 6 to 7 day immersion in revolutionary Paris, likely from the 12th to the 19th of May. From recreating the storming of the Bastille to standing in the rooms where the revolution actually happened, this is a once-in-a-lifetime experience designed especially for listeners of the show. Now, I'll be leading the tour in person alongside specialist historians, and because I want this to be immersive and personal, places will be strictly limited. In fact, there will be no more than 20 citizens on this tour. If you'd like to be among the first to reserve your spot and secure the early supporter discount, now is the time to grab your early access pass. The pass costs $100 and gives you priority access before bookings are open to the public, and it's fully refundable if your plans change. Furthermore, you'll receive a $150 voucher towards the tour, so it's both priority access and an early supporter discount. Half the early access passes were sold in the first 48 hours, so don't wait any longer. If Paris in May 2026 sounds like your kind of adventure, secure your pass today. And if you're travelling with family or a friend, you can purchase multiple passes to ensure each person receives the early supporter discount. Again, the passes are fully refundable if you don't use them. And with that, let's head back to revolutionary France. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Grey History, episode 103, Dechristianization, Part 1. In the final months of 1793, the revolution unleashed a new crusade. Determined to fight fanaticism in all its forms, regions of France embraced dechristianization in a violent and systematic manner. From the destruction of churches to the forced abdication of priests, this episode explores how the French Republic turned against its ancient faith. But before we dismantle the legends and myths of dechristianization, it's only right I pay homage to the true believers, the members of the Grey History community. Your support keeps Grey History preaching, so thank you so much for sponsoring these long pilgrimages through the archives. I'm so grateful for your unwavering support, and as always, please don't hesitate to reach out if you have any questions about the show. Of course, it's with tremendous pleasure that I get to welcome the newest, greatest people on the planet. A warm welcome to the newest virtuous citizens, Don, Nosta, Michael, Justin, David, and Ailey. Also, a huge thank you to the newest true revolutionary, Madeline. Thank you to every member of the Grey History community for your incredible generosity, and a special shout out again to the Pantheon of Heroes, Brian, Jeff, Kevin R., Scott, Howard, Hilberto, Kevin S., and Griff. On the 5th of October, 1793, the National Convention redefined time. For 1800 years, the French had used a combination of the Julian and Gregorian calendars. Starting the solar year on the 1st of January, the months had slowly filled with a litany of Catholic celebrations. Saints' days, festivals, and of course every Sunday marked the passage of time in a distinctly Christian way. Going forward, that was no longer the case. In September 1793, the convention had heard arguments in favour of a new Republican calendar. With anti-religious sentiment steadily on the rise, The nation's traditional calendar was denounced as a product of ignorance and fanaticism. Shortly thereafter, the convention took action and formally declared a replacement to be enacted in late October. Not only would the new year commence in September, but the structure of weeks, months, and even minutes would be completely overhauled. Initially, the 22nd of September marked a convenient location for the new New Year's Day. Technically aligned with the anniversary of the first full day of the Republic, it was also the autumn equinox, marking halfway between the summer and winter solstice. The latter helped to link the Republican calendar with nature, providing a sense of legitimacy other than the Christian faith. Henceforth, starting on the equinox itself, which fluctuated year to year, the new Republican calendar contained 12 equal months. Every month had exactly 30 days, composed of three 10-day weeks. It's here that I must deliver some grim news. Although proponents of the scheme claimed that workers could earn even greater income, only one of the 10 days was officially a day of rest. By replacing Sundays with the Decadi, literally the 10th day in Latin, workers forgoed a considerable proportion of their time off. Keep in mind that in the 18th century, Saturday was part of the working week, so workers were forfeiting roughly 30% of their rest days in transitioning to 10-day weeks. Moreover, that's not including the removal of things like feast days, which greatly outnumbered the new secular holidays. But on the bright side to losing several weekends a year, the new calendar had some entertaining names. Well, sort of. Hyper-rational in its design, the days were called the equivalent of first day, second day, third day, etc., etc. However, a poet-turned-deputy rose to the occasion. It's here that Fabre de Glantine, yes, the Fabre of the foreign plot, came up with a plan to individually name every single day. This proposal, as well as efforts to rename months, redefine minutes, and align a 360-day calendar with a full solar year, will be the focus of the first episode extra for this episode. So, to understand how we get months like Thermidor and Brumaire, and why your birthday might be celebrating everything from a turnip to a wine press, do make sure to check it out. For those wishing to calculate which day they're born on, I've put a link in the show notes as well. For me, my day is named after a poisonous flower. Not sure what to make of that. On a separate note, historian Matthew Shaw, a specialist in the Republican calendar, will be joining us for our first members-only interview episode in a couple months' time. With unique research and some quite novel perspectives on the calendar's purpose and success, make sure not to miss that episode when it airs in January. Yet, the convention's efforts to expunge an era of superstition and ignorance were hardly limited to a new Republican calendar. Indeed, for all the joyful pomp and pageantry, the final months of 1793 were increasingly bleak. With de-Christianisation breaking out across the country, pockets of the Republic experienced abrupt, violent, and all-consuming change. It's not for nothing that the subsequent events remain extremely controversial. But perhaps that's not surprising when those attempting to eradicate fanaticism were themselves fanatics. Now, to begin any retelling of the de-Christianisation campaign, it feels only natural to begin with the most famous proponent, Joseph Fouché. The notorious police minister of the Napoleonic era, Fouché is one of the most fascinating enigmas of the 1790s. Friendly with the Girondins in the initial months of the convention, the Jacobin convert has already featured in our narrative. You may recall that along with Collot d'Herbois, by then a member of the Committee of Public Safety, the two staunch Montagnards oversaw the brutal repression of Federalist Lyon. In fact, it was during their governance of the city in late 1793 that cannons were used for mass executions. Yet, it's because of Fouché's earlier work that he had been assigned to rectify the wayward city. That work involves an aggressive de-Christianization campaign starting in September, an effort that fits appropriately into his long career of violent and controversial measures. In midsummer 1793, Joseph Fouché arrived in the central department of Nevra. As a representative on mission, the deputy had been entrusted with the full powers of the convention. Initially, Fouché's activities were rather typical. Focused on eradicating support for the still ongoing Federalist revolts, the deputy also worked overtime to secure the acceptance of the new Jacobin constitution. Yet, as the Federalist threat gradually receded, and as Parisian Jacobins shifted towards sans-culottes demands, the ever-flexible Fouché commenced his own revolution. Relying on the support of local Montagnards, Fouché unapologetically embraced radical politics. According to historian Albert Mathy, Fouché believed that the revolution could only be saved by an energetic class policy applied for the benefit of the sans-culottes. Consequently, he vigorously pursued a popular economic and social platform, such as the creation of a committee of philanthropy in every district. Authorized to levy the rich to fund poor relief, surveillance activities simultaneously hunted down those deemed insufficiently patriotic. Likewise, Fouché took advantage of new price controls to enforce strict maximums on bread. In fact, so-called equality bread cost just a third of its previous price, while bakers were required to produce only one kind of loaf for the rich and poor alike. Now, while equality bread and other measures were subsidized by increased taxation on the wealthy, Fouché expected universal contributions. Given this new support from the state, the deputy outlawed begging. Idle persons had a choice: advance the revolution in some productive manner or face immediate imprisonment. Not to be left untouched, Fouché had demands for both farmers and artisans. If the latter refused to labour, their workshops would be seized and run by the state. If the former refused to bring goods to market, they were publicly humiliated, or worse, locked up in the pillories. The least severe punishment was a sign hung around the farmer's neck, characteristic of Fouché's blunt approach. It read, "Starver of the people, traitor to the country." Yet, while revolutionizing the rich, the poor, the farmers, and everyone else, Fouché's most infamous measures concerned priests and the Catholic Church. Indeed, Fouché's actions are generally upheld as the vanguard of the de-Christianization movement, even if that is an oversimplification. Long hostile to the clergy and unrestrained by proper oversight, the representative on mission launched an unprecedented crusade. Convinced that superstition must be eradicated in every form, developments in central France would be replicated across the country. Commencing de-Christianization with fanfare and ceremony, Fouché's first major act was celebrating a hero of the Roman Republic. This festival in honour of Brutus may sound innocent enough, but it's not for nothing that historian Louis Madelard presents it as a declaration of war against the Catholic faith. Commandeering the impressive Cathedral of Nevers, Fouché and associates undertook an aggressively anti-Christian celebration. Staffed by a mixture of volunteers and professional soldiers, the elaborate affair honoured virtue, old age, and misfortune. Tapping into sans-culottes ideals, marginalised citizens, such as the poor, were crowned with ears of grain, while others paraded everything from fishing rods and farm instruments to vegetables and branches. Yet, if this rather jolly occasion doesn't sound particularly irreligious, that's because we haven't discussed the speeches. Amidst hostile words towards the monarchy and the church, bold declarations demanded justice for symbols of feudalism and fanaticism. Evidently including the very cathedral in which they were gathered, Fouché proceeded to make use of this holy location to conduct unholy business. Praising the virtuous Brutus and likening him to a god, the deputy who was educated by Catholic orders, knew exactly what he was doing. For sincere Christians, equating Brutus to a god was blasphemy. To proclaim it in a church was outright sacrilegious. In upholding a pagan mortal, in promoting this classical idolatry, Fouché was repudiating core tenets of the Christian faith. Thou shalt have no other god before me is fairly clear-cut. Moreover, official reports added fuel to the fire, portraying the cathedral as a monument to enslavement and tyranny. Records claimed that attendees praised a new era of truth freed from religious error and trickery. Critically, this forerunner to the coming Festivals of Reason had national importance. While Fouché and supporters celebrated their civil festivities, these heathenish Jacobins were accompanied by a Parisian politician. As procurer of the Paris Commune, Chaumette was one of the most influential and prominent Hubertists. Indeed, Hubert was himself the capital's deputy procurer, and as discussed previously, Town Hall was swarming with ultra-radicals. Although Chaumette spoke at the festival and denounced tyranny and deception, his most important contribution was his ability to take notes. In the days that followed, Chaumette would return to the capital with his own ideas for anti-Christian celebrations. The seed had been planted for the de-Christianization of Paris. Yet, the Festival of Brutus on the 22nd of September was merely the start of Fouché's atheistic crusade. The next day, in supplemental orders, Fouché launched a fierce assault against the agents of unholy tyranny. Attacking a fundamental pillar of ecclesiastical life, Fouché abolished clerical celibacy, justifying his acts as a means to return the church to the purity of its primitive form. The centuries-long custom was branded as an affront to nature. Moreover, Fouché mandated that priests would be forced to marry, or at least adopt a child. Having given the clerics a deadline of a month to find a new idol for their devotion, Fouché proceeded to the nearby department of Allier. Here, he continued to implement a range of policies targeting the people's enemies. With the law of suspects now formally introduced, many had reasons to fear. Farmers, merchants, shopkeepers, traditional elites, even beggars, all could find themselves accused of hoarding, inaction, disingenuous patriotism, or other suspected activities. Of course, priests were targeted as well, with anti-clerical policies becoming increasingly common. However, developments in Allier went further, attacking not just the clergy and their traditions, but all outward signs of worship. With haste, crosses, statues, shrines, and other public symbols were all torn down and erased. Inside churches, sacred ornaments were removed as anything of value was seized by the state. Creating bonfires for items which couldn't be repurposed, the flames of this assault was fuel for both inspiration and terror. But while Fouché prepared to expand his iconoclasm, the clergy themselves were hardly left untouched. Going further than forcing marriages upon previously celibate priests, the destruction of symbols and relics were designed to promote fear and compliance. Denounced as impostors who still dare to play their religious comedies, the de-Christianizers succeeded in compelling renunciations. In Allier, the local bishop publicly resigned his post, followed by almost 36 priests. Fouché boasted to Paris of the regeneration of the people. Returning to Nevers on the 2nd of October, events in the capital were now fueling this steady acceleration. Almost a month since sans-culottes surrounded the convention on 5 September and demanded that terror be made the order of the day, the deputies had adopted appeasement policies which included the law of suspects, broad price controls, and the progression of the trials of the Queen and the Girondins. With the Hubertists wielding great power in the capital, Chaumette was now pushing his own de-Christianization agenda. Such developments to the north gave Fouché cover. Although the deputy was going further than some of his peers desired, Fouché was hardly going to be reined in when the already preoccupied convention was desperate to appease militant radicalism and avoid fresh insurrection. Given a free hand to continue his stern approach, Fouché remained fixated on propagating good principles. In early October, he synthesized weeks of anti-clerical actions into a distinct set of articles. Composing his infamous decree, these articles had profound consequences, reforming everything from public displays of religion to the conduct and nature of funerals. Fouché left few altars unturned. Declaring these reforms as necessary for the Republic's regeneration, Fouché intensified his increasingly limitless assault on the Catholic faith. The decree proclaimed, "Considering that the French people cannot recognize any other privileged signs than those of law, justice, and liberty, no other worship than that of universal morality, no other dogma than that of its sovereignty and omnipotence, considering that if, at the moment when the Republic has just solemnly declared that it grants equal protection to the practice of worship of all religions, it is permitted to all sectarians to establish in public squares and streets the signs of their particular creeds, to celebrate their religious ceremonies there, confusion and disorder would ensue in the city. Decrees, Article 1. All worship of the various religions may only be practiced in their respective temples. Article 2. Since the Republic does not recognize a dominant or privileged cult, all religious signs found on roads, in squares, and generally in all public places, will be destroyed. Article 3. All ministers and priests are prohibited, under the penalty of imprisonment, from appearing anywhere other than in their temples, in their costumes. Article 4. In each municipality, all dead citizens, of whatever creed, will be taken to the place designated for common burial, covered with a funeral veil on which sleep will be painted, accompanied by a public officer, surrounded by their friends dressed in mourning and a detachment of their brothers in arms. Article 5. The common place where their ashes will rest will be isolated from any habitation, planted with trees, under the shade of which will stand a statue representing sleep. All other signs will be destroyed. Article 6. On the gate of this field, dedicated out of religious respect to the spirits of the dead, one will read this inscription, "Death is an eternal sleep." Fouché's reforms were truly astonishing. Even today, Fouché's measures would be met with outrage, and understandably so. Think for a moment just the extent of this decree. Article 2 states that all religious signs on roads, squares, and in public places must be destroyed. In a Catholic nation like France, crosses, statues, and other forms of religious art might be found on every street, in every town, in every department. From the sculptures adorning churches to the crucifixes on countless tombstones, the amount of destruction required to implement Fouché's prohibition is simply astronomical. Moreover, Fouché outlawed all public displays of worship. Just 4 years earlier, the Estates General had been inaugurated with an elaborate procession and a Catholic mass. Now, congregations could no longer parade through the streets, while mourners were barred from farewelling their loved ones with the funeral customs that their ancestors had practiced for centuries. In decreeing the demolition of public religious symbols, and in forbidding the practice of long-held traditions, Fouché was fundamentally reshaping the life of almost every citizen. Not even Sundays were safe, thanks to the religious implementation of the new revolutionary calendar. Yet, as chilling as I find the line, "Death is an eternal sleep," others evidently found it inspirational. Before long, Fouché's harsh measures were emulated across the country. Priests were forced to marry. Churches were stripped of their steeples. Statues and relics were hauled to the ground as they affronted reason and equality. But before we examine how de-Christianization spread throughout the nation, I want to take a step back and ask some bigger questions. How is it that in late 1793, Fouché could implement such monumental reforms, which were not only tolerated, but widely praised and replicated, at least amongst radical revolutionary circles? Moreover, how is it that the freedom of worship proclaimed by both the monarchy and the republic could be so blatantly disregarded by a mere representative on mission? And why did this near limitless crusade commence right now in the autumn of 1793? It's been a while since we've discussed the relations between church and state, so it's probably best to start where it all went wrong in 1790. A year after the formation of the National Assembly, the original deputies sought to fundamentally reform the Catholic faith. As priests were now essentially employees of the state, thanks to the nationalisation of church property, the Assembly considered it a priority to rationalise and regulate the ancient institution. The resulting civil constitution of the clergy comprised extensive reforms to the faith's administration. Practically overnight, the powers of the Pope were curtailed, priestly elections were introduced, and some churches were even closed in an effort to reduce expenses. Critically, clerics were required to take an oath of loyalty to the still incomplete constitution, an act that many refused. The result was a split through the House of God. On the one hand, roughly half the nation's priests swore the required oath. These clerics became known by many names, including constitutional priests, juring priests, and patriot priests. Opposing them stood the other half of the church, led by most of the traditional leadership and eventually the Pope himself. Inversely, this cohort became known as non-constitutional clergy, non-juring clergy, and refractory clergy. Across the nation, regions experienced this split in different ways, with some pockets seeing almost universal acceptance or rejection depending on a variety of factors. Now, as the opposition of the Pope became known, along with the regret of the king, the politics surrounding the refractory clergy became increasingly tense. Come the Priscoan-dominated Legislative Assembly of 1791, Louis XVI used his veto to protect non-constitutional priests. Widely perceived as an enemy within, this trend was accelerated by the outbreak of war. Months later, the monarchy was overthrown, and with it, the protection for non-jurors. Henceforth, deportation to South America was now the punishment for non-constitutional clerics who refused to leave the country willingly. Just weeks prior, refractory priests had continued to preach in some departments due to an inability to find replacements. Churches were thus emptied as perhaps 30,000 priests fled the nation. Yet the departure of King Louis XVI also had a profound impact on the constitutional clergy. As you might expect, many juring priests were more conservative than the average Jacobin, particularly at a time when the Jacobin Club was moving so rapidly to the left that their former radicals, like Brousseau, were being shown the door. In the final weeks of the Legislative Assembly, the triumphant Jacobins legalised divorce, compelling the clergy to not only recognise divorces, but also marry divorcees. Additionally, priests were stripped of the task of registering births, marriages, and deaths, while religious orders focused on charity and education were abruptly suppressed. Causing further friction, the original oath required of certain clerics was expanded further, thanks to the collapse of the monarchy. Now needing to renew allegiance to the young republic, some declined, disgusted by unjustified encroachments on spiritual matters such as marriage. Amidst these growing tensions between patriotic priests and the government, a series of events drove the groups further apart. The September massacres, the execution of the king, and finally, the purge of the Girondins. That last event was key. Many constitutional clerics supported the ensuing Federalist revolts, further alienating the victorious Jacobins in the capital. In fact, historian Michel Vauvel notes that the Federalist crisis demonstrated that there was no such thing as a good patriotic priest, and that all compromise was illusionary. Thus, by the time the revolts were winding down, towards the autumn of 1793, relations between the Jacobins and the constitutional clergy were abysmal. Repeating recent history, both foreign and civil war had fueled suspicion of traitors within, this time against all clerics, rather than just non-jurors. As historian George Lefebvre notes, the hostility provoked by refractory priests had spread to Christianity itself. Lefebvre writes, "This legacy from the old regime inspired the civil constitution of the clergy, in itself radically at variance with the secularization of the state. Yet this became the leaven in the development of the latter. The schism it produced, after having led the revolutionaries to treat refractory priests as enemies, gradually detached them from the constitutional clergy, and finally from Christianity itself. As early as 1791, while the Constituent Assembly was granting the refractory clergy access to the churches, some departments were spontaneously taking coercive measures against them. The war extended these, and after 10 August, the refractory clergy were proscribed. It seemed that at least those priests who had compromised themselves for the revolution would remain respected. On the contrary, the hostility provoked by the non-jurors spread to their religion, bringing suffering to the constitutional clergy who professed it. On September 20, 1792, the Legislative Assembly finally created the civil state and instituted divorce. It was a decisive step towards secularism. The situation of the constitutional clergy became more difficult. Politically, they were soon suspected of being attached to monarchy, then to the Girondins. In October 1793, the convention permitted the deportation of those who were denounced as unpatriotic, and it created new difficulties for them in the revolutionary calendar and the observation of the 10th day. So, by the time Fouché was working in central France, in September 1793, the revolution had become increasingly hostile towards all clerics, regardless of prior oaths. Seen as supporters of the king and reaction more broadly, priests who had previously embraced the nation now found themselves suspect or worse. Combined with the growing power of the most radical sans-culottes, key pieces were in place for the outbreak of de-Christianization. It's here that we can return to Fouché in October 1793. 230 years after these events, it appears that the 11th commandment is "Thou shalt not discuss de-Christianization without mentioning Fouché." Given the striking nature of his acts, it's rather understandable. But a common misconception is that Fouché and his associates were the sole instigators of the de-Christianization movement. There's reasons for this misconception, but it's inaccurate nonetheless. Prior to Fouché's October decrees, anti-clerical actions were already underway in nearby departments. Indeed, some representatives on mission were experimenting with their own repressive policies, while local political societies vocally pushed others to implement aggressive measures. Likewise, the convention was advancing restrictions on all priests, even constitutional clergy. For example, unmarried clerics were banned from sitting on surveillance committees, while bishops were explicitly threatened with deportation if they obstructed clerical marriages or divorce. Of course, that's not to mention the new Republican calendar, which had at its heart a mandate to obliterate Christian superstition. So the gravity of Fouché's actions are not due to novelty, although some components were certainly new. Instead, Fouché's true innovation was formalizing anti-clerical policies into a coherent and distinct program. Furthermore, it was then coordinating this program with Parisian militants, local radicals, and the revolutionary sans-culottes armies, not to be confused with the actual professional army, although it would go on to assist in specific regions. In short, Fouché was systematizing de-Christianization. He was formulating a strategic approach to eradicate the preeminence of the church. Having been provided this vital blueprint, other deputies then proceeded to augment existing actions or commence their own anti-clerical initiatives. Moreover, the emulation of Fouché's deeds created a self-reinforcing cycle. Along with similar events in Paris, instances of de-Christianization fed upon each other, encouraging yet more extreme measures and outbreaks in areas previously undisturbed. As de-Christianization subsequently spread with unforeseen intensity, Fouché has since been upheld as an influential forerunner. This he most certainly is. However, neither he nor his allies should be considered the sole instigators. Other experiments in de-Christianization were already underway. Historian Louis Madeleine notes the importance of Fouché's work and its ramifications across the country. This famous decree remains one of the most curious monuments of the great attempt at de-Christianization of the year 2. The very novelty of the official decree was bound to be striking. Without doubt, as early as September, Chaumette had obtained in Paris more than one preparatory measure for the proclamation of official atheism. But this proclamation would not be made solemnly until the following November. In the first days of October, Representative Dumont preached atheism in Abbeville in a crude and violent style. But the codification of the measures, oppressive in brief and emphatic articles, elevated Fouché in the eyes of the entire party, making him a bold precursor who had to be followed. The decree of the 9th was published everywhere, propagated, and sometimes adopted as a decree of the convention. It was from this decree that most of the commissioners of the South drew inspiration when they tried to propagate the anti-Christian movement. Some do not hide it and recognize this paternity. It is in the name of Fouché, a sort of distant prophet, that 100 leagues from Nevers, crosses and images are broken everywhere, that miracle virgins are burned in Auvergne, in Gascony, and festivals of reason are celebrated, where priests abjure, deny their worship in outrageous terms, amidst applause or boos. And it is with proud satisfaction that the man, turning to his great pontiff, shows him with a fine gesture the Catholic country deprived of its cult, at least in appearance. Things are at the point, Fouché wrote to Chaumette a few weeks later, that the country where there was the most superstition no longer offers the traveller a single sign recalling a dominant religion. Now, with Fouché's actions providing a model for anti-clerical forces, the resulting outbreak of nationwide de-Christianization looks somewhat familiar. Symbols were destroyed, churches were ransacked, priests were forced to marry. Given these fairly common scenes, I think it's best we focus on what stands out. Humorous, or at least interesting, occurrences can help bring these events to life. Firstly, the destruction of Christian icons could at times be festive and extravagant. For example, one community executed statues of saints in ceremonial beheadings. More common were bonfires fueled by ecclesiastical vestments, holy texts, and any tainted relic of feudalism or religion. Amidst these bonfires, effigies of disgraced revolutionaries or foreign enemies might be added to the regenerative flames. Here's an account referencing British Prime Minister William Pitt and the Austrian General Coburg. On a tumbril lay the remnants of royalism and superstition, represented by crowns of fleur-de-lis, by skullcaps, clerical neckbands, papal bulls, choir stalls, and lecterns. Pitt and Coburg stood in the middle of this foul heap. The first carried this inscription, "The enemy of the people," on his back. The second, the inscription, "The true slave of a crowned brigand." The whole thing was pulled along by a donkey, dressed in a surplice and neckband, and bearing the inscription, "I am more useful than a king." Alongside the fiery annihilation of holy symbols were more systematic demolitions. On a smaller scale, great efforts were taken to prove the trickery of priests. In one instance, Couton, a member of the Committee of Public Safety and firm de-Christianizer, personally oversaw the education of misled citizens. Travelling after his time in Lyon, the deputy learnt that one town's inhabitants were proud of an enshrined vial. Said vial allegedly contained the blood of Jesus Christ. Summoning a public assembly, Couton asked an expert to conduct chemical analysis. Diagnosed as a type of coloured turpentine, the revelation was used to demonstrate centuries of deception. Days later, the local department propagated orders to tear aside the veil of impostors and dissipate those images of superstition which hold people in error and have degraded men. Yet, on the other end of this spectrum, demolitions could occur at far greater magnitudes. Across the nation, hundreds of church bells were removed and melted down, while churches themselves were stripped of any gold, silver, or other valuables that could fund the war effort. In fact, it wasn't just gems and precious metals up for grabs, but lead, copper, tin, iron, bronze, and anything else of use. Now, sometimes the war effort being funded might be specifically the revolutionary armies conducting these seizures. However, much treasure did make its way to Paris, even if pockets were being lined. Records show more than 2,000 addresses to the convention referencing the seizure of metals, and we know roughly 100,000 church bells were melted down across the country. Interestingly, because of the localized nature of de-Christianization, the contribution of each department could vary greatly based on a variety of factors. According to historian Michel Vauvel, those factors included the region's wealth, the intensity of de-Christianization efforts, its proximity to Paris, and the proportion of land which was once held by the church. Now, to clarify, a reminder that the so-called revolutionary armies seizing all these treasures were not the regular armed forces. Instead, the revolutionary armies had been created after the convention was surrounded on the 5th of September. A key Hubertist demand, these bands of sans-culottes were meant to export revolutionary enthusiasm and secure grain supplies for Paris. However, they also assisted in suppressing the regime's enemies, while in central France, they played a key role in the destruction of icons. Under no circumstances should these motley crews be confused with the Republic's regular armed forces, who currently had their hands full checking both the Austrians and Prussians. But in addition to 100,000 bells, the towers which housed them were also potential targets. Indeed, entire churches might be flattened or burned, depending on the region. Critically, these acts of mass destruction were highly localized, offering a fascinating insight into the complex nature of de-Christianization. Perhaps the most noteworthy examples of large-scale demolitions occurs in the departments of Mont Blanc and Art. These activities were mandated by the Jacobin deputy Albeit, nicknamed the Tiger of Art. We've actually met Albeit before, as it was he who oversaw the initial repression of Federalist Marseille. Relocated further north, the Tiger supervised the levelling of 800 steeples, in addition to other towers which offended egalitarian principles. For historian Xavier Marichaux, the events in eastern France prove the importance of individual deputies in defining local de-Christianization efforts. According to Marichaux, these demolitions would never have been possible without Albeit's enthusiastic support. Moreover, these departments, near the Swiss frontier, provide an interesting way in which to analyse how regional characteristics could potentially shape anti-clerical pursuits. As these departments were close to the border, many priests had previously fled abroad. With few priests to target, historian Michel Vauvel proposes that Albeit felt compelled to attack buildings instead. It's impossible to prove this hypothesis, but it's an intriguing proposition, highlighting how local dynamics moulded regional experiences. Vauvel writes, "It is interesting to note that the church, or rather its actual buildings, came under attack only in particular places. An obvious example is the famous bell towers of Albeit, when this representative on mission attempted systematically to raise to the ground these proud monuments of superstition, so that they would be reduced to the same physical level as that of ordinary citizens. Did this venture have any imitators? We come across it in the course of accounts dealing with the area covered by Albeit, in Mont Blanc and in Ar. Although it occurred somewhat late in the day, a function perhaps of climatic considerations, this measure demonstrates the obstinacy of one de-Christianizing representative. It is interesting to stress that evidence of the practice, unknown almost everywhere else, can be found to the southeast of the Massif Central, in the hostile region of Lozère, where we have confirmation that it also occurred during Ventôse. Did the representative who operated there, Châteauneuf-Randon, simply copy Albeit, whom he resembled in more ways than one? Without detracting from the initiative of these personalities, whom we shall be showing carrying out their responsibilities, we believe that we do not need to look too far to find a complementary explanation. Lozère and Mont Blanc. There were two areas which were virtually devoid of priests, for they were well hidden in Lozère, and they had left Savoy, and abdicators were rare. As there was no one to be stripped of this priesthood, the de-Christianization fury was vented on church buildings. This hypothesis can be confirmed by what happened in Puy-de-Dôme and in Cantal, where, according to some sources, and influenced also by Châteauneuf-Randon, iconoclasm expressed itself in the same ways. Thus, for example, at Saint-Flour, where, using the excuse of an exercise, a church was attacked with heavy artillery, the commentator added, "We should have been very satisfied had the chapel been filled with priests." This was harsh humour, or maybe it was not humour, a comment on the vengeance taken against stones in the absence of men. So, while full-fledged demolition was rare compared to, say, forced marriages or the destruction of icons, the levelling of towers and churches was common in specific areas. Moreover, it appears that the demolitions and their timings were reflective of unique factors, such as the local representative on mission. As mentioned previously, de-Christianization looked vastly different between neighbouring departments, and the role of key personalities cannot be overlooked. As an aside, the church mentioned by historian Michel Vauvel was Saint-Flour. Towns like Saint-Flour were named after saints, and in late 1793, that was a no-no. Across France, perhaps 8% of communes changed their names to drop references to religion or monarchy. In total, that's more than 3,000 communities. Now, it would be a lengthy digression to analyse what these names were changed to, as well as how different regions experienced different trends. So, that will be the second episode extra for this episode, titled Renaming France from Towns to Babies. Yet, having discussed how de-Christianisation could vary from region to region, it's important to stress just how divergent local experiences could be. In some parts of the country, de-Christianisation was violent, while in others, changes to Christian life were comparatively peaceful. Looking upon a map of France, it is clear that intense de-Christianisation was concentrated in distinct regions. The first was Paris and its surrounding departments, extending northwards towards both Normandy and northern France. The second core can be found in central France, including, but not limited to, Fouché's area of operations. The third might be characterised as a sort of southeastern corridor along the Rhône River. This area naturally included the city of Lyon, but it also expanded to aspects of both the Alps and the Mediterranean coast. Finally, isolated pockets of de-Christianisation could be found in the southwest, notably around Toulouse. Against this, a host of French regions were relatively unaffected. Northwest Brittany remained largely untouched, while the Vendée was experiencing a rather unique situation thanks to the priority of the Civil War. Carrying on south, most of Aquitaine and the Spanish border were comparatively undisturbed. Indeed, with the exception of Toulouse, so too was much of the southwest. On the eastern frontiers, most importantly Alsace and Lorraine, de-Christianisation was particularly subdued. Likewise, the Republic's southeastern corner was also spared, with the Alpine departments generally left alone, with some noteworthy exceptions. The end result is a map of France which is a real mixed bag. From extreme intensity to minimal disturbance, abrupt and sudden changes could be found across the nation. Now, I know what you must be thinking. Why? Why was it that nearby departments could undergo such different experiences? The simple answer is, it's complicated. Firstly, there were those factors that we've already discussed. I can't stress enough the importance of the individual personalities and politics of specific representatives on mission, but also other local factors, like regional officials and the unique effect of location and climate. One way in which location can be seen to be having an impact is those areas near routes of communication. Off in a corner, the isolated Pyrenees departments remained largely undisturbed. The Spanish border was quite some distance from central France, and other isolated regions were usually left untouched. However, regions close to Paris and Lyon, as well as those along their transit routes, tended to be impacted. In fact, you can use local archives to track how separate outbreaks of de-Christianisation seeded similar actions in nearby towns. Building on this further, those regions with smaller populations, such as rural areas, generally escaped the most vigorous measures compared to larger urban centres. Yet, in addition to location and the presence of radical Jacobins, there is a third factor which might seem counterintuitive. Although by no means a perfect match, regions of intense de-Christianisation usually correlated with those containing a high proportion of patriot priests. In other words, departments with a large and active cohort of constitutional clergy were generally hit the hardest. Now, that might come as a surprise. After all, it wouldn't be unreasonable to expect the opposite, that areas with intense measures were actually those with large numbers of non-constitutional clergy. So, what exactly was happening? Fundamental to de-Christianisation, especially early on, were public ceremonies designed to inspire regeneration. Notably, this included forcing priests to marry, recant aspects of church doctrine, or abdicate their posts altogether. But in order to do this, you needed to actually have priests. In those regions where much of the clergy had rejected the civil constitution, those clerics had already fled. Liable to arrest and deportation, many had emigrated abroad, or at least gone into hiding. Thus, by late 1793, it was only the constitutional clergy still practicing in public. So, if you wanted to create elaborate ceremonies of forced marriages or renunciations, one had to target constitutional priests. Their non-constitutional cousins simply weren't an option. Accordingly, regions with more patriot priests often endured more de-Christianization. Fouché's department of Allier offers a great example. There, roughly 90% of clerics had originally sworn the constitutional oath. 90% provided plenty of misguided souls for Fouché to re-educate, both in terms of everyday citizens as well as the clergy he accused of misleading them. Inversely, those regions with a high proportion of refractory clergy were sometimes left alone. Here, religious communities had generally followed the guidance of their renegade priests, like what we've seen previously in the Vendée. By late 1793, these non-jurors had been driven underground or out of France, but the persecuted priests still enjoyed significant community support. Consequently, local representatives on mission were keen to ensure they didn't inadvertently trigger another Vendée. The result was less destruction and a significant reduction in the seizure of precious metals compared to other departments. These trends reinforced the correlation between the presence of constitutional clergy and the experience of intense de-Christianization. To be clear, there were exceptions, but these generalizations usually held true. So that's de-Christianization, at least in the provinces. In Paris, well, that's a whole other story to be explored next episode. From Robespierre's resistance to the influence of the foreign plot, get ready for fireworks and temples of reason. Thank you for listening to episode 103, De-Christianization Part 1. Next episode, we turn to Paris itself, from forced abdications to sacrilegious festivities. I hope you're prepared for a wild and controversial ride. As always, thank you so much for your incredible support. Grey History only exists because of your generosity, and I simply can't thank you enough. If you ever have any questions or thoughts about the show, please don't hesitate to reach out. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your support. Stay safe and have a great day. Grey History is brought to you by its amazing community members, including the Heroes of the Revolution, Brian, Jeff, Kevin R., Scott, Howard, Hilberto, Kevin S., and Griff. Joining the amazing heroes are the fantastic Champions of the People, Cindy, George, William, Laura, Daniel, Monica, Adam, Tom, Eyal, Harold, David, Alistair, Jeff, Retus, Cameron, Dan, Paul, Deborah, Susan, Danny, Gordon, Matthew, Sophia, Kevin, Scott, Jersey, Alvaro, Eric, the whole country of Luxembourg, Randy, and Barbara.